Hi, I'm Andy Staples. On today's episode of the College Football Inquirer, we're going to talk about the new world of college football, how stuff works now that the schools can actually pay the players. We're also going to talk about coaches that have to win right now and some very intriguing week one games where you might see a group of five team upset a power conference team. But of course, we're going to talk about the elephant in the room. As you know, the great Dan Wetzel left Yahoo for ESPN. And of course, I'm trying to fill his shoes. Now, I know I can't do that. Dan's one of my favorite people in the world. And I can tell you right now, I'm no Dan Wetzel. But we're still going to have a lot of fun on this show. Of course, I'm not the only voice you're going to hear today. The great Pat 40 has left the show as well because he's exclusive to Sports Illustrated now. Also one of my former employers. So to join Ross Dellinger, we bring in the amazing Stephen Godfrey. You know, this may sound strange at first, might feel a little bit different, but we appreciate if you stick with us. This is going to be another great college football season. It's going to be weird. It's going to be wacky. There will be a lot of twists and turns, but fortunately we will have guardrails and everything else that makes this show wonderful. And this loyal audience, one of the best in the nation. It is football season again. Let's go. This is the College Football Inquirer, and I realize I don't sound like Dan Wetzel. And I'm sorry about that. I'm Andy Staples. This is the new College Football Inquirer, and we let us address the Big Al, Alabama mascot-sized elephant in the room. There's different people in the room. Ross Dellinger is still here. Guy who's own Ross Dellinger. Hi, Ross. How are we doing?
I'm good. Good to be back.
Also here, Stephen Godfrey. You know him. You love him. From Split Zone Duo Podcast. You can read him. Washington Post. Other very fine publications. Godfrey, how are we doing?
I'm more of a live mascot. I would just prefer to be, like, I want to be something that has to have handlers.
So Mike the Tiger...
Yeah, I mean, I would do Tom the Tiger.
Bully the Mississippi State Bulldog. Ross is very familiar with him.
Incredibly affable mascot. Kind of slept on in the mascot. Like, way more approachable than Uga. Less diva tendency.
I agree. Uga feels like...
Good morning, Athens.
Yeah, in the times that I have interacted with Uga, he seems a little bit uninterested. Bully has always been far more affectionate.
Yeah, he's happy to have the job. Maybe that's why Godfrey's sticks around longer than Nugget does.
And we're trying to, rein him in on the field as he's galloping. I forgot the buffalo's name. What's the new buffalo's name?
Ralphie.
Gosh, how can I forget that?
Well, she's always named Ralphie, and then there are other names.
That's right.
This is probably a later in the show segment, but there have been some message board posts expressing massive dissatisfaction with the current Ralphie.
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about that.
The rookie year of Ralphie, the freshman year. Was unsatisfactory, and perhaps they need to go in the portal for a new bison. But again, we probably need to talk about the buffalo in the room before we do that.
New lineup.
So,
yeah,
for those who've been living under a rock the last few months, Dan Wetzel, who we love, who, by the way, if you have not read his story that came out on ESPN.com over the weekend about a high school athlete, it's a very sad story, but a very necessary story that I immediately emailed to my 16-year-old son. Read that. But Dan is at ESPN now doing wonderful work. He's always going to be one of our favorite people, and he wishes us very well on the show. I texted with him the other day. Pat 40 is exclusive to SI now, so he cannot do the show anymore. But we, of course, love Pat and congratulate him on a fantastic new deal. So here is the new lineup. And we're not going to try to do the same show because that's an insult to you guys. We wouldn't do that to Dan. And besides, he's better at it than me. So why would we do anything like that when we can just do what we do? And what we're going to do is we're going to talk about college football in a lot the same vein that Dan and Ross and Pat talked about college football. We're going to take you very deep into the sport. We're going to take you very deep into how the sport works. And I think you're probably going to enjoy it. So guys, I think we probably need to talk about stuff that's happened since this show has been off the air, because
a few things,
essentially, Andy. The entire one or two.
Yeah.
The entire
what happened?
Way they compensate athletes has changed. Like, the thing they said would never happen.
Oh, yeah.
Schools paying athletes directly is happening.
So surely the sport is completely different and doesn't look the same, and the powers of old are gone, and there's a whole new order, right? Like, if I were to look up the top 25 right now, it would look totally different, right?
Yes, Akron is number two.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no.
Let's go, Zips.
The field has been leveled.
Shout out to Joe for sticking it out.
The kangaroo. But, all right, Ross, I feel like you were the best person to help explain this, because you've been putting this in English better than anybody else for years. How does it work now? For those who are coming into this thing and saying, okay, the schools can pay the players now, how exactly does that work?
Yeah. How long you got, Andy?
We can be
here
all
day. It
can
get complicated. Yeah. Let me break it down. I think the easiest is that, you know, now there are three sort of buckets for athletes, you know, as far as compensation. And one is the same as has always been, right? It's scholarship and benefits and all that stuff. And I think the second bucket is the rev share piece directly from the schools, which each school getting as much as, 20.5 is sort of the salary cap for each school. They can spend up to that in the rev share. And then the third bucket is the one that has caused so much of an issue, as we know, and that is the NIL bucket, which still does exist, third-party endorsement and commercial deals for athletes. So there's kind of these three buckets that an athlete gets, and a lot of the rev share deals, or some of them at least that I've seen from schools, break down the buckets, right? They break down how much scholarship and money that an athlete will get. They break down how much rev share money an athlete will get. And then they even mention potentially an NIL figure with contingencies that NIL figure, that bucket, may have to get approved, obviously, by the clearinghouse, which is a whole, right, another topic that we can dive into that's been very certainly at the front of the news over the last few weeks, as you know, college sports is unlike sort of any other entity in that it involves big donors, school donors, historically paying players. And I think the house settlement and the rev share era, one of the things college administrators wanted to do was stop that or limit that, as they have been trying for, it seems like, 100 years. And we're starting to see, in the last few weeks, we're starting to see challenges already against the clearinghouse in the denial of some of these booster collective deals, that is going to be very difficult to do. And so that's kind of where we are right now. And I would imagine that we'll have more challenges over booster pay in the clearinghouse denials in the next few weeks and months. This will be a continuing thing.
So, Godfrey, you brought this up. You brought up the idea of, oh, did nothing change? I'm curious, when you look at this, what do you think could change? How do you think this could change the sport?
In the short term, I was going to ask Ross, if I have kind of glazed over as a casual fan, understanding that when one of these things happens in DC, when one of these things happens at the conference level, or someone comes out and says something, I can register that it's important. But if I'm an Alabama fan, if I'm a Florida State fan, and then we go kind of down and even into the mid tier, what, if anything, am I looking for as we like toe meets leather in 3 weeks or a year from now? That's what I'm trying to discern right now, is what initially is going to feel like it's changing this sport if I'm standing at a tailgate in October. Because for now, it feels like it's still a little bit of business as usual. And it has that sort of iceberg idea of, like, I know things are happening, but I don't know what, as a consumer of the sport, am I going to feel in the short term?
Yeah, I'm smiling because recently I was thinking of a quote that I was meeting with a coach, and I was thinking of a quote he said to me, because I asked him what you're asking me.
Okay.
And he said, Well, the parking lots have changed.
Yeah.
So
now they don't all have to have mysteriously appearing Dodge Chargers. You get a multitude of vehicles.
Dodge Charger, by the way, one of the most popular fleet vehicles in the country. Thank you, police departments and law enforcement all over the country. Yeah. Easily customizable. Thank you, Mopar. Now DJ Lagway drives a Lamborghini to school.
The parking lots have changed.
You can still do a Challenger. I'm not speaking ill, okay? There's a part of my redneck DNA that's always quietly whispering me, you should buy a Dodge Charger. But
you know what you can
get whatever you want.
You can get a six-inch, you can get a Raptor and 6-inch lift that bitch. TRX.
See, I think
I didn't realize.
Here's the beauty is the ag schools can now, like our cultures can now reflect in the parking lot, right, Ross? Like you can get a diversity of vehicle.
That's right. And I've been visiting some campuses lately. I would say that the coach's comment is accurate. The parking lots have changed a bit. But I don't know. Are we going to see anything different? I think the one thing that fans see that's different or that's something that makes them frustrated around the tailgate as they're talking or on the message board is the amount of player movement, right, is the transfer portal and the transfers. And I think we're going to touch on that later because there's a pretty big decision potentially coming up in the next few days or weeks on the transfer portal. But that is the one thing. It's not really the money. It's the movement that I feel like the fans have more of a frustration level. And that's the biggest tangible change maybe to college athletics.
Andy, to that end, the question you asked me. We're being so friendly now because it's episode one. You sent out a couple ideas yesterday about what we were going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to answer the question you asked me, except all the topics, and I'm not trying to do a show overview, but we're going to talk about coaches in win now scenarios. We're talking about who could be shocked in week one. I think the answer is this is trickling into all the other aspects of what we normally address, of what we normally pick apart. And so it doesn't have an obvious seismic change. But I think, to Ross's point, it's not the money, it's the movement is affecting every other aspect of the sport.
Well, let me talk about the movement, because I think this is what's interesting about now the schools can pay. So you get $20.5 million, which is a percentage of basically the average power conference revenue or the average power conference budget. And that number can change. It's sort of like the NFL salary cap will move based on football related revenues. This can move as the years go on. Practically though, Ohio State was going to have all this money to pay anyway, because they're Ohio State. They can just, sound the alarm. The boosters will come in.
Yeah.
Iowa State never had that. Vanderbilt never had that. And that's where I think this is interesting, because I was watching the SEC documentary on Netflix the other day and watching Vandy beat Alabama and watching Diego Pavia and Eli Stowers. And the thing I hadn't thought about until I was watching that is, if not for rev share, they wouldn't be at Vanderbilt this year.
No. There's the short answer. Here's the shortest answer I can give you. So I was there, but I wasn't supposed to be, because I live close enough to Vanderbilt where I can hear the foghorn. And I was off that weekend. I was putting together a smoker in the backyard. Very SEC behavior.
Very good.
And the Post called and said, hey, and I had another game on outside, not Vanderbilt, Alabama. Who would put on Vanderbilt, Alabama in that slot, right? Right? So, and I'm not paying attention to the crawler. I have my phone in a place, but I'm doing something. And they say, hey, don't you live near Vanderbilt? You know how when the assignment editor calls you and you're like, okay, Nashville. I don't know if you're aware of this, but they're about to beat Alabama. So I just... So whatever I was wearing to build a grill, I threw a sport coat on top of it and just Ubered into and walked directly into the stadium as time was expiring, taking video of the entire thing, just trying to get a raw feeling for it, because I had to basically thrown into feature writing. That moment is technically impossible without what has occurred in this sport. So there's your answer, Andy. That one moment. Now, how much did that one moment ultimately affect college football? And the season, we could do a playoff discourse about
Bam
nine
out
wins.
Of playoff.
Right. We can go there, but God knows our predecessors as well as the entirety of our media corps has beaten that to death. That has changed the sport in a discernible way. That is your one answer, because I think, not being a recruiting person at all, It is the highest star rating assembled for a roster of four-year players, whatever that means exactly. In other words, like the highest percentage of player lost to a Vanderbilt team, the core of which was assembled via New Mexico State. That sentence is actually like factually impossible 5 years ago.
And hey, sounds like a lunatic. Was a four-star recruit who signed with Texas A&M originally. He just wound up at New Mexico State.
that process alone, right? Like there, as we get into the season, there are going to be some really fun things we can talk about that we've had transfer history before, but we've never had the fun experiment of like, hey, let's graft South Dakota State onto Wazoo, or let's we could talk. We've got Southern Miss to talk about in a second.
But what I meant about this is Diego Pavia and Eli Stowers would not have been back at Vanderbilt this year in the system that existed last year. Vanderbilt would not have been able to afford to keep them.
Guys, Vanderbilt tickets right now are going for hundreds of dollars. I have LSU in-laws who casually thought they would do what they always do when they play in Nashville, which is come in like an invading force, walk up and buy a ticket cash for $20. You can't do that. Vanderbilt is a commodity. Now, however short-term this might be because of the ephemera of last year, they are a commodity 2 years in a row. That also feels physically impossible 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. Player movement, it can be a positive for many, and that is like the biggest impact. So to go back to like what we're talking about, it is more about the movement than the money. Mm-hmm. The fact that a Vanderbilt can get those players and amass a team that can beat Alabama's, it's a good example of sort of a big change.
Well, okay, Ross, let's delve into the other piece of the big change. Is the creation of the CSC, which is the new version of the NCAA in terms of enforcing these particular rules around the compensation of players. And what it does is your third party deals, you submit them, they say yes, this meets fair market value, they say no, this does not. How does that process work? And there've already been challenges to it.
Yeah, it's been interesting, right? So I like to think that I break the College Sports Commission like up into another three sort of buckets here and what they oversee. And one of them is sort of a cap management system, right? Where every school files their roster and how much they're paying each roster spot through this LBI system that the NBA and other pro leagues use. So they manage that sort of deal. And then they have, or they will have eventually, an enforcement and investigative staff to sort of investigate a lot of the same things the NCAA used to, but maybe more toward the rev share piece. So the tampering and sort of all that stuff, non-compliance. And then the third piece is the clearinghouse, right? With the NIL Go clearinghouse that Deloitte was hired to sort of craft. In a logarithm for, you know, certain deals, NIL deals. So let's talk about the clearinghouse and how it sort of works, because that has been the one criticized, most talked about.
Yeah, because it exists. This. Correct me if I'm wrong, guys. So that a school doesn't just have a booster say, "I'm going to give you $2 million just for being you," and
right.
That just becomes, you know, in addition to the rep share money that player is getting.
Yeah. And there are two, like what I like to call, like within the clearinghouse, there are two firewalls that would prevent a deal from getting approved and prevent the player from taking the money and being eligible. So the first firewall is the valid business purpose of any kind of deal. So can you prove the deal has sort of a purpose? Can the business and the athlete prove that this is a real deal that's for the business is using to make a profit?
This would be DeColdis Crawford, you know, doing the HVAC company ad in Nebraska.
Yeah,
we're never going to have example. That kind of
symmetry. Yeah, there you go.
It's a good Ross, example, by the way, this is most of these are just endorsement, right? We're trying to discern commercial sort of endorsement
sort of deals. Yeah.
Meet and greets became the kind of the crux, though, when the House versus the NCAA plaintiff's attorneys challenged this, because the CSC put out guidance and said, Okay, well, if it's a company that just exists to funnel money to the athletes, then we're going to automatically deny that.
Okay.
Well, collectives have a business purpose. They may not like the business purpose, but it essentially is the same business purpose as, say, a concert promoter who charges an extra $100 for the wristband that lets you go to the meet and greet after the show. Like, and that's where you already had a problem. So how did that get resolved, Ross?
Yeah, well, the first firewall, the valid business purpose, was definitely challenged, as you mentioned. You know, I think that administrators that are running the CSC wanted that first firewall to be the main stopping point for all booster deals before you even got to the second firewall, which I'll talk about in a minute. But the first one, they wanted all deals to collective deals to stop there by saying what Andy said, right? By saying traditional booster collectives aren't treated as a real business, thus they can't have a valid business purpose. So it basically prohibited most, or if not all, booster deals from getting past the first firewall. So they denied dozens, if not into the hundreds of deals. And then obviously all this is part of the House lawsuit, right? And the House plaintiff attorneys have a role in all these decisions. And so they were notified of these denials of these collectives based on this valid business purpose deal. And they challenged it, right? They challenged it, and we're going to bring it to the magistrate judge who will oversee all of this as related to the court. And the NCAA, or well, I shouldn't say the NCAA, the power conferences, because they really run, they really control the CSC, they sort of backed down in a way, and they changed the original guidance, allowing certain collective deals now to move past the first firewall. And then there's the second firewall, which is range of compensation. And that is like the Deloitte sort of deal. That's what Deloitte has created, this algorithm that basically gives a range of compensation for certain NIL deals, and they have to fall within that range of compensation or they'll be denied. So that's kind of what's left. I mean, there's still this first firewall, right? But they've clearly going to allow things that they weren't originally going to allow through it. And so as long as a business can, as long as a collective, let's say, right, can prove that they are making a profit from whatever they did, and
they're trying to make a profit, because lots of businesses don't make profit.
Sure, yeah, that's a good example, right? Some businesses don't make a profit till 3 or 4 or 5 years into their existence, right? Or they never do, and they close.
Yeah.
The first thing that a collective has to do is just say, like, I'm trying to make a profit. The second thing they have to do is provide the public and fans of whatever goods and services. So what will be allowed, from what I understand, is things like speaking engagements and autograph signings and golf tournaments where you have players appear. Now, does all that meet the second firewall, the range of compensation? We don't know yet. We don't know if that will be challenged. The odds are, just like the first firewall, the second one is going to be challenged as soon as deals are denied, right? Could you imagine it playing out like this? Like, a collective hosts a golf tournament and pays a player $40,000 for attending. That gets submitted to the CSC. It gets past the first firewall. And then the second firewall, Deloitte's algorithm says, well, that's supposed to be a $10,000, not a $40,000 deal. Then
how would that hold up?
That's a good question.
I have a lot of questions. My first is, in what universe are we regulating range of payment in any other free enterprise?
Yeah.
And how is this not labor? I mean, for my voice to go up, like,
yeah, if somebody's dumb enough to pay me $40,000 for a touchdown club speech, which has never happened, by the way, but if it could happen, I'm all for it.
It could. Are you listening, Texas Tech?
That's right.
Well, what's the old saying? The fair market is whatever the market will
whatever
pay.
They're willing to pay you. Yes.
Yeah.
So are we not throttling a free market here?
Yeah. Well, I think many believe that we are. I think eventually we will see a challenge over the range of compensation once deals are denied, either from the House attorneys that challenged the first one, or either just lawsuits filed on behalf of players or businesses or collectives themselves as well.
So more,
yeah, I had an AD argue with me about this. This is months before the Howell settlement went into effect, but the they'd already come up with the what they wanted to do. And this AD was saying, well, you know, we'll be able to monitor that and police that. And I said, how in the world can you? He said, you know, the athletes are opted into the settlement by taking the rev share money.
Right.
And so they have to go to arbitration. And obviously the schools have to go to arbitration. And I said, that's great. But if I'm business owner A who wants to pay this dude $100,000 to come sign autographs at my car lot, you have no right to tell me what I can pay them and what I can't. And I'm going to sue you. And the person's like, oh, yeah, that's literally what's going to happen.
So, Ross, when you lay this out, acknowledging that there is more legitimate cash going to the labor here, to the player. I don't want to take away from that. It's not like nothing's changed.
Oh, yeah,
I'm not trying to be myopic, right?
Yeah,
like, yes, more legitimate, obviously. Like, because I was privy to the old numbers and, like, you know, having an open market is beneficial to the labor, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So acknowledging that massive change in the whole cars in the parking lot thing, it sounds like nothing else has. We are still so we're still in a state where the ruling class of the sport, retaining whatever thin little academic backbone in terms of its ideology, is still somewhat in control. The conferences still are uncomfortable with the actual engine of their success, which are boosters, right? The people who pay for the glass buildings, the people who pay for the NIL collectives, the people who pay for whatever the legendary coach asked for. But we're still, that ruling class is still a little uncomfortable with their behavior when it comes to interacting directly with the labor and wanting to basically play brinksmanship with each other constantly in the offseason, in this wonderful 9-month offseason where they all go to the same golf courses and the same country clubs and they get drunk and argue with each other and they try and outdo one another. So nothing has really
changed. Players can afford to belong to those country clubs now, so they may just argue with each other there.
Right.
But
so as usual, the only true winners here so far that we've established are car dealerships. So nothing has changed actually in this sport.
Well, but not people who sell lots of Chargers, because those sales have gone down.
We are killing this potential sponsorship. Dodge. I'm here.
Yeah, new electric Chargers, by the way, and Challengers.
I need to know how many car seats can get in the back of a 2-door.
So Ross, you mentioned this earlier, and before we get into the actual football of this season, let's start with the one more potential seismic change. That could be an offseason that could define the next offseason. You were talking about what might happen with the transfer portal, what might happen with the schedule, and that's coming fairly soon.
Yeah, so there's sort of been an ongoing debate of the timing of the transfer portal, right? Which now there are, is it 30 days in December or 20 days? I always forget. 30 days?
I believe it's 20 total? Now, because I think they 20? Shrunk
okay.
they shrunk the
That's
two
right.
windows
and there's
down.
There's 10 in April. So now you have a 20-day fall and then maybe a 10-day spring. Well, there's a thought that we need to get that to one portal. That's what the people who make decisions about college sports want, is one portal. Coaches and athletic directors and commissioners, they want one single portal. There's a decision on when. Everybody seems to agree on that. Those people seem to agree on that, right?
Okay. Which, by the way, does seem insane. That does seem insane.
Yes. Yeah, it does. Okay. It does. Yeah. Just in the NFL.
I'm Mr. Player's Rights, but one portal would be
pretty
awesome.
We're not even saying this from like a selfish, lazy writer perspective of like, please just make it happen once. It does seem insane that it happens twice in an off-season cycle.
Right. Right. And so the thought is everybody sort of agrees on one. It's just when will that be? And most agree that it should be in January. They've sort of come to that conclusion that early January should be the portal window, 10 or 12 days, somewhere around there, the 2nd through the 10th or 2nd through the 12th. But there's one league of importance, the Big Ten, that believes it should be in April for a variety of reasons. And so there's been a little back and forth on that now for a few months, or it's coming to sort of a head where the Big Ten is ultimately just going to be outvoted, right, by the other leagues. Whether that's through the NCAA, like the old sort of NCAA governance system of voting, or through the College Sports Commission board, which is just the board of the four power conference commissioners. So I would guess within 2 weeks, maybe something like that, that there'll be a final decision. And I would be surprised if it doesn't end in January, end up in January. I think 2 weeks ago at Big Ten Media Day, Tony Petitti, the Big Ten commissioner, who's very much in support of an April, like many of his coaches, portal. I think that he basically told me, right, like he anticipates it. They just getting outvoted. And it just
why does the Big Ten want April, Ross?
Yeah, I'm curious here because I think I like April, but yeah, I'm a little worried about the company I'm keeping.
Well, well, yeah, so it's interesting because I think there are probably some underlying reasons that aren't being said publicly. But the public reasons are the April.
Wait, these officials are disingenuous? Ooh,
new segment. We're not stealing yeah. segments from the old show.
No,
we
got to
just
going to
piss
own.
You off yeah, if you love yeah, the old yeah, show. Yeah. We're not doing that. New segment. Ready? Find yeah. the angle.
Yeah,
the new segment is called Find the Angle. Let's find
everybody's
the angle.
Got an
What's
angle.
The Big Ten's
Everybody,
angle on this?
Yes, everybody's got an angle. Well, I think the public reasons are that, April more aligns, for one, with the revenue share year, which is revenue share payments, which, goes from July 1 through the next June.
For the accountants. So
you're pushing that. Yeah, you're pushing that later. The second reason is it more aligns with the academic calendar, which, of course, ends in May. Usually, some schools
as
end
a group
in June.
Of AAU universities would be expected to support.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Except Nebraska,
so
they got kicked out of the AAU.
Yeah. And the number three reason, and maybe the biggest one I hear about is it happened. You want it to happen after the season, right? You want the postseason to end
yes.
before you would have your free agency type of
yes.
Time, just like the NFL. So those are the three reasons. The fourth unsaid reason that you hear many from the SEC and other leagues believe the Big Ten's desire for April is weather. Weather.
Okay.
That visiting a campus in May or April is better in the Big Ten than it is.
I was trying to guess all the various angles.
In January.
And I didn't have weather.
Weather. Weather is weather.
Have any of y'all been to Northern Indiana in the first week of April? Who are you fooling?
Well, it's 45 instead of 25, I guess, Godfrey. I don't know.
Well, this is
I was going to say, the last time I was
we
in
are
Bloomington
a panel
in the
here.
Spring,
this isn't
it very
work.
Much snowed on me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. All of us are from a very low latitude in the continental United States. But, like, no, every time someone talks about this as it relates to, like, April is suddenly this marketable event in the Big Ten. One, look at the baseball schedule. That's physically impossible. And I always point back to the NFL draft was held in Chicago in late April, basically May one year. And every time they did a wide shot coming in, they would like wipe to Grant Park or wherever in Chicago. No leaves on trees, just sky as gray and dead as possible. Mm. Okay. Everyone is aware of the weather. The money is supposed right. to compensate for the weather.
If,
okay.
If the weather meant anything, Arizona State would win every national championship.
Absolutely. And Illinois being in the top 15 right now is not because the weather is nice ever in Champaign, it's the money. We fix this problem with the money, okay, guys? This is why the Packers can win Super Bowls. We abandon some of this pretense. Here's the frustrating thing. I agree with one thing very strongly. The idea of separating out our the events in our cycle in the college football world, we as media, the shareholders, everybody. This is one thing that whether you like the NFL or not, or you believe college is a superior or inferior product to the NFL, that's not the point. The NFL is exceptionally good at dictating mind share, and college is woefully terrible at it, possibly because college doesn't have a centralized governing body, shockingly enough, and no one's actually in charge. But if we could move this into an event separate of the actual college football schedule, Ross, you said January 2nd to the 10th?
Yeah. Something like that.
We're,
yeah.
We're doing something then, guys. Like we're in the middle of our playoff.
Yeah.
We're in
yeah.
the middle of our playoff, guys. We oh, are trying.
But that's a nice little hole there between between no. the quarters and the
between
semis.
The quarters
Andy,
and the semis.
That is Andy. That's masochism for everybody involved in
thinking
you know.
Like a programmer.
Every assistant coach listening to this right now is just dying a little bit.
So here's the deal with this, because from talking to coaches about it, because my initial thought was it should be in April. because you finish up your academic stuff at the end of the spring. Yeah. You just move spring practice into June and have it more like an NFL OTA situation. And I thought that made the most sense. And I had some coaches tell me, perfect, makes great sense. I had way more coaches say, absolutely not. I need my team in January. I need them to go through the offseason program with my strength coach. I need to build a culture because this is not the NFL where I know I have these guys coming back. I don't know who I have coming back. And I may have 70% new players, and I need that time. That's what they're saying. Not that I necessarily agree, but that's how they feel.
And we're anticipating, a 25% roster turnover for we're talking about the ruling class right now, the top 50 programs. Let's estimate what somewhere in the neighborhood
of 50% a year.
And
the Big Ten and the SEC.
Okay.
Yeah, like the SEC coaches, this was their big 25 argument,
in, 25
right?
out. Destin, like,
Was like, we need to know who our team is in January, February. We don't need to wait. And part of the reason was, and they gave the numbers, Kirby Smart did specifically, is 30-35%. That's what they said. Okay. And that may be a low, you know,
that
a
feels
low number,
conservative, but yeah, that makes
that's,
sense.
But that's what they talked about, is like a third of your team. Not only do you not know what a third of your team will look like because they could potentially leave if there's a spring portal or whatnot, but as a few of them have said, maybe not publicly, but you're paying a third of your team to sit around and then leave you. So that's been an issue too. There's no like great answer here because college athletics shouldn't be tethered to it's gotten so, and this could be a whole nother podcast, but like major college athletics has gotten so big and has made so much money that it probably shouldn't in a way be tethered so closely to the academic calendar, but it is because of this higher education thing. And it just kind of ties everything and just makes this murky, you know,
Rossum.
And hard to
wise man once said a very honest thing. And is it, he didn't come here to play school. One thing I would add, because I am conflicted here, Andy, we are, you asked again earlier, it's like the thesis of the day, what is changing? Mm-hmm. The disruption and the amount of personnel turnover in the pockets that we have now. I attempted very foolishly to do sort of like an off-season gossip thing. It was assigned to me the first week of March. I called a Power Four assistant coach that I've known forever. And I said, hey, look, they're asking me to do this. It's a print deadline. It's a disaster. Can you tell me about, you know, the idea being that they could anonymously scout like their division or their conference. And he just said, look, I don't know who's going to be in my room. I don't know who's going to be in my position group room right now. The thing that bothered me about this was not their stress. We potentially could see an evolution towards a sameness in schematics because coaches are telling me now we're getting effective. We're getting crucial start game one, week one starters in 4, 5, 6 sometimes so late in the cycle. We are oversimplifying all of our schemes, offense and defense, because we almost need a universal programming language, if you will. Because again, I say this, I've said this my entire career, and I'll keep saying it. People who aren't in this business don't understand how little time you get in college for install from week to week and in the offseason. They see Hard Knocks and they see these documentaries about the NFL. Guys, it's nothing like that. It has to go faster, which is why we're all going to have a lot of fun conversations
and
about Bill
and
Belichick.
And also the guys in the NFL are so well-versed because they played in three systems in college, and they played in five systems in the league that you hand them this 4-inch thick binder that's your playbook, they already know 90% of it.
Yeah.
It's not the same in college. This is why, by the way, the service academies now have a huge advantage because those guys aren't leaving. And they run a very specific offense that requires tons of reps. But guess what? They can do that. And what did you see? Army and Navy were really freaking good last year, and people really struggled to defend them because you don't have time. And I'll to your point, Stephen, Mike Gundy, the Oklahoma State coach, told us at media days at the Big 12, basically the majority of his two deep at that point had not practiced with the team. And they have now
terrifying.
For about a week.
That's 20 years ago, a coach is terrified. And they're quietly signaling out to local media, hey, lower your expectation. Now it's just sort of practice. It's just, I mean, it's a functional difficulty for most programs. What is the average amount of starters on a contending team right now who basically have no experience with that particular group unit scheme? It's a significant amount, even at the best programs.
I mean, mm-hmm. Ohio State is replacing nine, depending on how you count it, defensive starters this year.
Right. But the expectation won't be the previous generation's expectation for a defense that's essentially turning itself over. We expect plug and play if we're Ohio State fans. You want to know why? Yeah. We paid for it. We wrote mm-hmm. that check, guys. The school wrote some of it, or maybe, again, Dodge Charger. But mm-hmm. we have an actual investment, and there's an expectation of ROI.
Yeah. You know,
exactly.
So did we come to a conclusion? When do we all want the portal to go?
Oh, yeah, we nailed it.
I think in an ideal world, it's April, but I think in reality, it's going to be January, and it probably has to be.
So what about something the other outside option? I would love preservation of football is what I'm asking for. And it's not Ross, it's obviously not your fault.
Those pesky registrars to just let you get into class on the 21st.
Yeah.
You could do like January 21st through January 31st. And that be your window. And free agency starts like day after the national title game. Yeah.
Could be a problem with the academic world, couldn't it?
I'm not holding it against the people who are reporting on or creating the actions right now, but we have been in a glut for 2 or 3 years of completely overshadowing the sport while it goes through these sort of revolutions. We've got to, someone has to stand up and say, all right, we have to preserve the product, right? Mm-hmm. Again, it's one of the things the NFL is exceptional at. It's one of the things the NBA has screwed up a little bit, and you've seen some redirection this past cycle of news overshadowing the NBA finals. In the NFL, that won't happen. The NFL has
completely mastered the calendar.
Yes. That's what I would like to see in college.
No other sport has.
Yes. That's what I would like to see in college.
College coaches will point to and say, can we just do what they are doing? But again, Andy, academics.
But this is the pursuit of a higher education.
Their free agency is in March. So.
Yeah. I mean, so there's a third option here, potentially. January, April, and staying what you have now, which not a lot of people want to keep two, but then there's an argument to, well, do you eliminate the spring and do you just keep one where it is now, which is immediately after the season in December, while you're playing bowl games and coaches turnover?
At least if you push it to where they're talking about having it, there's only four teams left playing. That would be
effective. And most coaches are filled. Most vacancies are filled, so you don't go through.
And you don't have the Bo Prabhula situation. For those who don't remember, Bo Prabhula was Penn State's backup quarterback last year. Had to play Drew Aller got knocked out of the Wisconsin game. Bo Prabhula had to come in. Bo Prabhula left the team before the playoff run with James Franklin's blessing. James Franklin wasn't even mad about it. Like, but understood,
not the fan bases.
Right. Mm. And Franklin said, look, I get it. Like, somebody's going to pay him a bunch of money to be their starter next year. He expected to be our starter, but Drew Aller surprised us and him by deciding to come back. We obviously want Drew back. So we understand we have to let him go. And he's ended up going to Missouri. And Missouri's not paying for him to potentially get hurt playing for Penn State. So you avoid that scenario unless... But then you potentially have the even worse one where a team makes the Final Four and the backup QB splits as the portal opens. Now, if the portal's open through the national title game, theoretically, he should be able to play and then do what he does afterward. Because let's be real here, he's already being tampered with, so he knows where he wants to go.
What if we pushed it even further into summer and we could reverse this weather jinx by actually negatively recruiting the SEC? Because, again,
it's like 100 degrees
aside from some of the obvious... Aside from the
your official visit in Gainesville is on July 15th. Yeah. You're never signing with Florida.
98 degrees, 98% humidity. Enjoy.
Everyone wants to talk about
112.
It's an idyllic October in the South. Yeah, well, it's not an idyllic, mid-July, early August.
I love
it. Just a thought.
Find the Angle is my new favorite segment because it's our first one. But we'll probably have one of those every episode because something will come up and we'll be like, what's the angle?
Because it's college football.
Exactly. Guys, we'll be right back. Talk about the coaches who need to win now. Welcome back to the College Football Inquirer. We have talked about structural change in the sport. Now let's talk about something we always talk about at the beginning of every season. Who's in danger of getting fired? And because this podcast takes a business of college sports bent, I think this is an ideal way to start discussing this because, guys, there are coaches who, under normal circumstances, would have been deep trouble this year, who are far too expensive to fire, whose buyouts are impossible. So let's, before you scream at your car radio because we did not mention X coach, I'm not going to mention Mark Stoops as a coach who needs to win now. Why? Because Mark Stoops' buyout, I believe, is in the neighborhood of $37 million if he's fired after this season. And his contract calls for that to all be paid within 60 days. So guess what? Mark Stoops is not getting fired. So we'll move on without him.
And Mark Stoops coaches, like, he knows he's not getting fired.
Yeah,
there's a lot of those, Stoops, right? One, there's
Luke Fickle,
there's one,
Mike Norvell, Lincoln Riley,
Brian Kelly. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of those that 50 million and plus probably buyouts.
Yeah,
the Mike Norvell thing is the sleeper Jimbo. I mean, I don't want to derail the segment, but we could do a month. I have a lot of thoughts on.
Okay.
Let's talk about that
because this is part of the discussion.
Yes.
Let's take you back to 2020 after the 2023 season. Mike Norvell has just gone 13-1, 13-0 before they get jobbed out of the college football playoff.
Mm-hmm.
The Alabama job opens. He legitimately was one of the people Greg Byrne was considering. Now, I don't know if he was choice one or choice two. Kalen DeBoer might have always been choice one, but Mike Norvell was absolutely someone they were heavily considering for the Alabama job. So you really had no choice as Florida State but to make that deal when you did. And now it's just the biggest anchor.
It's the exaggerated Mel Tucker, even without the Mel Tucker scandal. Because if memory serves, Mel Tucker signs the mega extension before the Ohio State blowout, or the terms are agreed to basically before.
Yeah.
He's in that one magical
LSU's
situation.
Open, we're scared.
Yeah. Exactly. Andy, are you asking, could you have played it another way? Probably not. Could the terms maybe have been a little bit lower? Was Alabama actually going to follow through? Where was he in the pecking order? A lot of people got well off of Nick Saban retiring in the short term. No, by the way, I'm not casting aspersions there. That's the job. That's what we do. That's why those agency buildings are
really,
really pretty. Well,
especially Jimmy Sexton having the guy who was retiring and the two finalists, essentially.
Yeah, it's always good to have. Yeah, if you have 12 chess pieces on the board and they have two, you're probably going to win the game. No, but it's nor could you have forecasted what would happen to or it would nor could you have forecasted the degree to which that things happen in Tallahassee. Yeah. But now you are left with something that looks worse than Jimbo. At the it's program true. That swore Texas A&M would rue what they did for Jimbo. Mm. Just a little bit of
irony. And they did.
And they did. And then you turn around and you did the exact same thing based off of the one good season. I'll be curious if that snap judgment, sort of the knee-jerk reflex on extensions, Andy, I'm curious if that changes in the coming years.
He did cut his salary in half.
He did this year.
I can't remember what he gave back, like $3.5 or $4 million, I think.
Yeah.
Which really just covered the expense of firing his coordinators.
Correct.
On multi-year deals. It basically covered the buyout.
I would be remiss not to mention the Gus Malzahn hiring, because I do think that's the way you mitigate the problem, or the best way you could mitigate the problem.
Mm. Right. And, which, by the way, that saved UCF a lot of money because they were going to have to fire Gus. And I don't know that they had
the money to do
quite
it.
Quite a bit
Wait,
of cash.
Wait, Andy. Whoa. Amicable parting. Everyone was really happy.
It was very amicable. I'm going to save you some money and go here.
Yeah.
Thanks.
What do you mean firing? What are you talking about? We're still in the lot. We're going to be. Here's the problem with the segment we created. We could do it every segment.
Yeah.
Where's Yang?
I would have, if I was going into 25 and we were not in the new era, I would have said, all right, we had a logjam in the SEC, inertia in the SEC last cycle. So I'll just tack on the usual suspects in the SEC to some degree or not, right? And some of the contracts are immovable. I'm not talking about Stoops, but we could do this real fast, right? We could do Venables. Okay, we could do Pittman, right? We could do Napier, all to some degree. Maybe Freeze, maybe that's a little bit early based on the contract.
Oh, no, Freeze isn't early. So here's why Freeze isn't early. Freeze is the most manageable buyout of this bunch. Freeze is about $15 million. Billy Napier is still about, you're talking about $20 million. It's very expensive. Venables is over that. Venables is closer to $30 million. But if Venables is bad, you probably have to do it.
Let me propose something that is new to this culture, new to the world that we're living in now. Because those would be the number one, two, three, four list guys, right? We would go through, maybe we'd talk about Fickell, and there's a couple G5 guys off the top of my head. In no other world would a year four Texas Tech head coach who's coming off of eight wins, right? Okay. That feels really normal. That's part and parcel for life at Texas Tech.
Best since Mike Leach. Right. Talking about
we're sitting around
guy
we're
Joey
going,
McGuire.
Okay. All right. Joey McGuire seems things seem to be going along as they maybe should-ish. Maybe there's a little bit of expectation. But now, could you imagine a world in which he finishes with 8 wins this season and that is tolerated?
No.
Seems impossible.
Okay, so for those who've been living under a rock, this is one of the bigger stories of the offseason. Texas Tech, essentially blank check to go improve the roster through the transfer portal.
Yeah.
And they did. And if we look at their personnel in terms of guys that are draftable prospects, it's very different than what you would normally expect from Texas Tech. Joey McGuire, we've talked about this. Like, he understands the situation. Like, his ass might get fired if he doesn't win the Big 12. Or at least play for the Big 12 title. His buyout's under $10 million. One of the few seven-figure buyouts in the whole of the power conferences. So he gets it. But this is a new piece of the new world of college football. When you make that investment, you'd better cash it in.
Right.
You know, what's really interesting is that the new world and sort of this new era that we're in has had sort of opposite impacts on coaching decisions that we're talking about right now. Think about Napier last year. Without the rev share era, maybe he is actually fired. But because they have to pay $20 million to the athletes, they're not going to pay $20 million to the coach. And now we're talking about them firing, right, a Texas Tech coach because they spent so much money on the roster. It is really fascinating. And I agree. There's perhaps no coach in America with more expectation and weight riding on his shoulders than in Texas Tech, which is crazy to say. But that and it kind of felt similar in a way last year with Ohio State, because we knew the number. The AD said the number to me in last July of $20 million. And you could feel that weight and hear that weight on Ryan Day throughout the whole season, the postseason, and then finally it released, right, like a popping a bottle of champagne at the championship game.
So this, Andy, not to be redundant, is the answer to the original question today. Because in any other universe, we would not have had the SEC stand pat through an entire coaching cycle. But to Ross's point, just adopting the mindset of, is this the best way to spend our money? Is flushing off the buyout? We got to slough off the buyout. Maybe the coordinator's got to buy out these days, right? We got to go out and hire a staff. We got to go out and pay coordinators over X, right? So it's got to be impressive. So it's not just the one big number now. It's a series of big numbers, and we kind of have to do it twice depending on the buyout. That used to just be the prevailing logic in sort of the height of the, we'll call it the Sexton era. But if you have payroll concerns across your roster, what if, guys, we look at a Florida situation and say, all right, what if there have been some growing pains, to put it lightly, in Gainesville? What if we tweak personnel? What if we tweak parts of the staff? What if we adopt a long
view?
It's actually
what they tried to do, and they got so much juice by beating LSU and Ole Miss that he didn't have to hire a play-calling OC, didn't have to change DCs,
right,
which was part of the agreement when they decided to bring him back the Thursday after the Georgia game. But really, it came down to, and this is, you know, Ross mentioned all the different things you'd have to pay. It also came down to these players want to play for Billy Napier. DJ Lagway, in particular, the quarterback, wants to play for Billy Napier. If Billy Napier is not there, DJ Lagway is probably leaving. And it was more, okay, if we don't keep Billy Napier, we don't keep DJ Lagway either. And if we do the math on all this, maybe our best chance of success in 2025 is keep them both.
Yeah.
So now he's got DJ Lagway. He's the starter this year. We'll see how healthy Lagway is. But now it's year four. They've been a 500 team with Billy Napier. So they have to be better. Like, they have to be pretty competitive against one of the toughest schedules in America. Or at that point, they will just say, you know what? Clear the decks, starting over. That's it. But you're right.
Yes.
There are so many more layers to the decision now than there used to be.
And I don't know if the consumer has picked up on this yet, because I've done so much work on hot seat stuff over the years, and people, you know, I'll get questions on Phantom Island, the other podcast I did, where people are still sort of operating that mindset of, he hasn't won X by Y equals firing. And I get it. That's how we operated for multiple generations, right? Now I think we have to look at, so like what Andy just said, if we would have clipped it earlier, is a trope. The players really like playing for him. We heard that for years. It just didn't matter because we could just force another coach on them.
You have, you know, the best center in America in Jake Slaughter. You have a potential, you know, high round draft pick at defensive tackle in Caleb Banks. You have DJ Lagway, obviously. Like, now having those guys is so freaking valuable. Like, them on the open market,
and they have
can't
a say.
Buy.
Yes. Yeah. And yeah, no, yeah. To your point, Andy, DJ Lagway likes to play for Billy Napier. That's not a sentimental bit in a feature story anymore. That is equity. Agency is really what I should. I mean, there is equity obviously there, but the agency of the player. Now, is it LeBron picks the next head coach? No, but it certainly is something. There's a percentage there of agency amongst the players that we've never seen before. So this is going to arrest and manipulate how we look at hot seat. Now, Billy Napier still has to win. Okay,
yes.
Pittman, all those guys that still have to win. We are going, and by the way, we're going to see some movement in the SEC.
Freeze is the one I would watch, because I think that's one of two directions. Because if you look at Auburn's roster, it is as talented as they've had in a long time. It's the best Auburn offensive line in 10 years. Receivers are excellent. Keldrick Falk is one of the best edge rushers in the country. They should be, with that schedule, knocking at the door of a playoff berth. So if they have the same season as last year, that's it for Hugh Freeze.
I would also,
but
we have to add some context here. This would be an interesting conversation, Andy, at 8-9 in that Mendoza line of playoff. If they're bumped off by Illinois, or we're doing the North South thing again, whatever. Okay, that's one conversation. There is an Auburn ready head coach at arguably the best program in the G5, sitting and waiting. And we all know this.
John Summerall,
all talked about.
Him.
Yeah, we all talk about this. That definitely compounds matters. And if I'm John Summerall right now, and his reps who I've spoken with, they're feeling pretty good because there's a lot of options, right? You're feeling really good. But that definitely exacerbates the situation with Freeze specifically, because look, I've been doing this long enough to understand Auburn. Farm cult, whatever you want to call it. You know, guitar church, maybe America's biggest publicly funded guitar church. John Summerall understands. John Summerall has enough Pat Dye DNA to plug and play, and he certainly has the league experience.
But he lose his pants in the water hazard of a golf course and have them be discovered 40 years later? That's what really matters here.
You're gonna have to look.
Andy?
Slightly remember this reference.
Oh,
you're gonna
Ross,
have to walk
you don't know that
out.
Story?
Yeah. What are you talking about?
That's like coffee table book old. Like, go.
It's, this you're is one of the it. Like you graduated from Mississippi State. You should understand. Like, this is the kind
me.
Of SEC lore I thought every school taught. So I'm gonna have to look this up the exact year. But at some point, someone discovered a pair of Pat Dye's pants. In a water hazard in a golf course. So, okay, it was 2008. The pants were gone for 23 years. They had his wallet in there with his ID. That's how they knew they were his pants. Of course, the idea that said pants were found at the bottom of a water hazard brings up a lot of questions. How did you finish the round? Were you playing by the rules that say if you don't hit it past the ladies' tees, you have to play the rest of the hole without your pants? I don't know.
Yeah. All of the athletic directors listening to this, Ross, all of your, all the people you talk to, you know what they're all thinking right now?
Mm-hmm.
That's by far the best possible situation for we found my head coach's pants in a strange place.
Yeah, it could be a lot worse. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. That story could be.
Well, we've had, pants could be found had, in other places.
That could correct. Be with not, hi, not his wife's underwear wrapped around the gear shift of the car while during weeping, the traffic stop.
While,
like, that's
while
happened.
Weeping to the state trooper. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
See, there's old college football and there's new college football.
There's new. That's right. Old in a swamp found. Yeah. In the new. On the,
oh, yeah, man. He's such a card. He was out there golfing and something happened, right?
So do we know
which,
what
by the way, I would assume it's a digestive tract issue, or I'm going to try and be really diplomatic here. That has to be the assumption, right? Like, well, don't know. Those are ruined beyond measure. So I'm just going to throw that in there.
Just going to throw them into the pond.
Wallets and all.
With my ID.
So his ID, they were Madras pants, by the way, plaid.
Okay.
Wow.
Lake Magazine, which I guess chronicles the lakes in and around Alabama.
I thought the name
had
of
a photo on
Lake
the cover with the woman who found the pants, handing the pants to Pat Dye.
My goodness.
I wasn't the only one who thought the lake was named Magazine. And then I thought, do they have a journalism school? God. Okay.
His Amex was in there.
I'm proud that I wasn't the first person to derail the show. I feel very confident now. I feel like I took my first sack and now we're good, Andy.
This is great. I'm just glad we've told this story to more people.
But you can't speculate on it because I feel bad, like I would be implying that Pat Dye did something untoward. And, you know, maybe I have no explanation.
Well,
for
I speculated. Look, most dudes know that rule.
Right. That has to be
don't hit it past the red tee. Now, the rule is really don't hit it past the red tees. You have to play the rest of the hole with your pants around your ankles. But maybe the ankles needed to breathe.
Oh, gosh. Mm.
The
We've
Lake
detoured
Martin
a little
edition
bit. We've detoured
of Lake
into
magazine.
The
so
yeah,
this magazine covered multiple lakes.
Wow. Wow. Mm. Sounds like a fun job.
I don't think it's a water hazard. I think it was the bottom of a lake. Mm. So
maybe it's on a boat.
The first
on the
thing
lake,
we're gonna get mailed about. This is I'm
Godfrey
I'm,
might be ready. It was a boat on the lake, you know.
Yeah.
Had a little accident, throw the pants into the lake. I don't know why you would throw your ID in the lake too.
It's
the wallet was in the pants.
Here's how I say this on a family friendly Yahoo show. Go look up the George Brett story on YouTube. That was my assumption. Does everyone know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. We can leave it there, right? We can
speak. The pants are now in a frame, by the way.
Well then maybe wasn't that. Or things got cleaned up.
Where are the pants framed?
Yeah.
I think.
Please say a restaurant. Please say
Pat Dye was given the pants or put the pants in a frame. So
please say it's a restaurant or a church.
No.
Church restaurant.
By the way, someone wrote 6,000 words on these pants.
That's wow. Yeah.
In the War Eagle Reader.
Maybe the lobby of the football building.
This industry's dying. We need somebody to get some work.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
I'll make a podcast out of it. 6 hours. Let's go.
Before we break. It's my fault. This is all my fault. But
okay,
we do. Let's talk about Brent Venables 2 seconds because that's a situation that I think is very unique to this era. Because if Oklahoma is not in its second year in the SEC, I'm not sure the situation feels as urgent or as dire. Even though Oklahoma kind of number two behind Ohio State in terms of programs that just don't have down periods,
right?
But they can't afford to have one here at the dawn of their SEC era. So either he's going to win with John Mateer as his new quarterback from Washington State and Ben Arbuckle, the wunderkind OC from Washington State, or they are going to get devoured by this schedule, which is one of the hardest schedules I've ever seen. And they're going to have to get somebody new. And, oh, by the way, longtime athletic director Joe Castiglione is retiring. The former AT&T CEO is basically running the show these days. He's already put in a general manager, Jim Nagy, the former Senior Bowl director, who has more NFL-like GM powers. So this is going to be a test case.
Like a Ron Rivera context at Cal? Are we thinking it's that kind of overreach?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think it's overreach. This is what he was hired to do.
Reach. Yeah. Authority. Before we get started, I want to preface this theory by understanding, I completely understand why Oklahoma did it. And if I was running Oklahoma, I wouldn't change a thing. But did anyone lose more in terms of win-loss than Oklahoma in the latest round of realignment. Yeah, what I mean by that is we got it. We were lulled into this, not, you know, the reality where Oklahoma was almost a turnkey playoff in the four-team era, right?
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah.
Win the Big 12. Maybe there's a loss. Maybe you drop Red River, or maybe it's a non-conference game. You're almost guaranteed 10, 11 wins, and you're going to walk into the playoff. Now, what Lincoln Riley did in the playoff is a different discussion, but Oklahoma had access in a way in which that I don't know if anyone ever will again. And now, the reason I bring that up is that's the context. It's always about the context of the people who are making the decision to hire or fire you. Or in college football, it's also about just all the rich people who don't have the power but clamor a lot and buy the Chargers. Yeah. That's the brain. That's still the mindset of Oklahoma football. Also, just real fast as an asterisk, what's going on in Austin is happening, right? That's the most functional we've seen Texas in the modern era of college football.
Everybody's pulling the same directions.
Yep. Which finally happened, which I probably would have bet against ever happening. All right, so that's going on. And now, as Andy said, you're facing one of the most brutal schedules in college football. And by the way, it's not like 26 would be dramatically better. As an Oklahoma fan, you have to adjust to the reality of, you know, it used to be like we'd beat up Tulsa. We would play like a good one, and we'd have a good 1-1 agreement with somebody. And then we would feast on the bottom of the Big 12 until Red River. And there's one or two games and then Bedlam. This is never going to happen again. So what if your baseline, and we don't even know this, we don't have enough data, they haven't been in the league long enough. What if your life now is somewhere in the 8-9 range, yeah, and Venables, yeah, hits that mark this year, which is what I'm getting at? Like, what if
I push back against that, because the Big 8 was a different animal and scheduling worked differently back then.
All right.
But they always played Texas. So remember, for the longest time, Oklahoma Texas was a non-conference game. So they always had that game. And then, of course, they always had Nebraska in the Big 8. Now, granted, the rest of the Big 8 historically didn't put up much of a fight, but Oklahoma would go play a bunch of really good schools. So my point being, they've always been good. Throughout that era, they were good. And even when the Big 12 would rise up and you'd see really good, 2008, for example, with Texas Tech as an 11-1 team, like Oklahoma was still the class of the league, played for the national title. I think they can be dominant in the SEC as well, because they are not a place that accepts mediocrity.
What does dominant in the SEC mean anymore? I'm not trying to overstate this, but...
Well, no,
especially
I agree.
The expanded playoff era, right? Yeah, I mean, everybody's going to be...
Alabama's making the playoff with multiple losses.
That's it. So we're talking 8-9-10. Yeah, 8-9-10.
That seems to be the Brian Kelly marker this year, too, where it's just like, we're going to overlook a lot right now. Yeah. Just get to the playoff.
Finish the top 4 or 5 in the league and get to the playoff.
Yep.
Right.
That's okay. I wouldn't push back on that, Andy, that they expect to be a playoff team. I'm just curious if they can, if it's a good 8 this year, is he okay? A good 8 wins. A good eight is actually
probably fine because of the schedule. If you look at Oklahoma's schedule, their last 7 games are the hardest consecutive games I think I've ever seen on a schedule. So it starts with Texas. I'm calling it up right now, but it is.
Well, does a good 8 mean beating Texas?
That would probably be a piece of it. Listen, if Oklahoma wins 8, guys, they've probably beaten a playoff team in that bunch.
Yeah.
So,
and they're going to be on the bubble of the playoffs. So probably be ranked like 18
or 20. Now, in the non-conference, they've got Michigan. And then in the early season, Auburn, their SEC opener is against Auburn in Norman, which is might be a loser leaves town match, if we're being real. Mm. But here's the last 7 games. Texas and Dallas, at South Carolina, Ole Miss and Norman, at Tennessee, at Alabama, Missouri and Norman, LSU and Norman. If things go badly... We'll roll downhill so fast.
Ole Miss is probably the worst team in that lineup, and they almost made the playoff last year.
And their quarterback, Austin Simmons, is going to be really good. I'm telling you right now.
This might be, I say worst in sort of like a finger quote context. It's just that because they're in a transition year with a new quarterback, that's if you win any combination of 8, guys.
In that scenario, you're probably
logic should prevail here.
Yeah. But Godfrey, you know,
I'm just not sure you will. It's the same with Napier, actually, that you kind of are either going to win 10 or you're going to win 5 or 6.
Okay.
Because if you're that good, you're probably going to win 9 or 10.
I think what I'm projecting against is maybe more parity in the upper class, above the line in the league, because I think, and this is just, we can't help ourselves because this is also our jobs. We have 1 year of data on this culture. We have 1 year of data on how this plays out. Maybe last year is the aberration. We won't know. We don't know if we're going to be, if we have an outlier for another 4 or 5 years. But let's just say we're moving towards a lot more parity.
Yeah.
And but then, I think, yeah, exactly. It does, Ross. And also, just for the sheer fact of, like, again, going back to Andy's wonderfully constructed thesis, what has changed? The environment of college football means you are no longer stocking one war machine program in the Southeastern Conference on the defensive line anymore, or on, you know, the front seven or the offensive line. It's not that Kirby Smart's worse at calling a defense, guys. It's that Kirby Smart doesn't have every single available five-star in a cycle the way that Nick provided.
Jalen Carter is no longer backing up Jordan Davis.
Those days are gone.
Yeah.
And so everyone has a gap. And it's not because, Nick Saban, the genius, is gone. No, it's actually the reverse. You couldn't do that anymore, so Nick Saban, the genius, left. And so I assume a level of parity, I think, Ross. And it seems like, actually, you would know this best, Ross. Are the power behind these programs, are they resigning themselves or accepting this reality? Or are they still of the belief that you can build a dynasty at that level?
Well, I think plenty of them, like the Georgias and the Alabamas, we've seen them fight against a lot of this for a reason, right? Because it has impacted them negatively in their rosters. I think we've seen them fight against various aspects of sort of the new world. One thing, Godfrey, we like on this show, we've had a lot of conversations about this exact thing, about realignment and how many programs traded money for championships. And
yeah,
there's plenty, right? Washington, Oregon, USC, all those that moved right to the Big Ten. And think about even after USC and UCLA made the move, what was left of the Pac-12. Think of Washington and Oregon's chances in that group of programs and how often that they would have had a route to an automatic berth in the playoff compared to an 18-team conference that spans the country, right? Like, so
and we
I think
had
a lot
that
of,
discussion,
you know, a lot of those
while
teams are in that.
George Kliavkov was farting around with all the various potential streaming deals. Like, why wouldn't you, if you're Oregon, Washington, just ride it out and figure it out? And they... When all the stuff went down, in a heartbeat they went to the Big Ten.
Yeah.
In an instant.
Yeah.
For a half share.
I started this whole thing saying, Oklahoma, I totally understand why you did it. I would do the same thing. It hurts a little bit, as naive as this is going to sound, for some sense of purity. Because, and let's see how many times I reference this now that I'm on this show. So I grew up a Georgia Southern fan. At the FCS level, there were a lot of programs that were very wise for a long time who realized the product that they were delivering, the actual product. And for a long time, some major programs, then they were called 1AA, refused to move up or just kick the can a decade because they realized the product they were delivering, Ross, were those wins, those championships, right? People were celebrating a Southland Conference championship, or they were celebrating an OVC championship or Big Sky or whatever it is. And this still goes on in the FCS to this day. I know it doesn't compare to the billion-dollar FBS. I get that. But there is a sort of sadness I have, and I'm curious if Oregon and Washington, just to use them as a random example, spend a lot more time in the wilderness. And Oregon, I mean, look, Oregon was the number one seed going to the playoffs last year, so maybe that's not the best example. When are the fan bases going to revolt, if they do? Or maybe they're just happy saying, hey, you know what? We were 9 wins this year. We were competitive. We were the number 6 seed. We haven't won our conference in 9 years, but this is what it's about now. Maybe that changes, and maybe I'm just being like kind of old and sentimental.
Well, you know, like the Pac-12 specifically, maybe this isn't the same connection like Oklahoma and Texas fans have with the Big 12, but like the fans of Washington, Oregon, even the California schools, the connection that they had with the Pac-12, like you kind of hear that was more of like a sad thing, right? And I think a lot of the fan bases believe, I think they feel like that, like this is sad what's happening. But there's also something like bigger here. I don't want to just put it to trading championships for money. It kind of what all these schools sort of did was trading being what they say being left behind for being right. in the group that goes sure. on and is in this new, right, 30, 50 team, 40 team thing, amorphous thing that we often talk about. But let's just be honest. I mean, everybody knew during that realignment what was probably coming at some point. You have to pay the athletes directly. Like, everybody kind of knew that was going to come. So what do you need? You need money to do that. And so it was just, in general, a chase to get money for the preparation in the new era, but also the preparation for not, you know, to avoid being sort of left behind. The funny thing is, if, you know, USC and UCLA never leave, if Texas and Oklahoma, even before that, didn't leave, then you would have potentially delayed what we're talking about right down in the distance from now. You would have probably pushed it off a little more, this big Super League sort of thing. But now that they made
I thought you meant rev share. No, yeah, definitely.
No they would have. Two things. Yeah, I'm kind of conflating them. But like, there's this rev share that was always going to happen, and probably around this time period, as soon as the house case was filed, which was the same a year before Texas and Oklahoma made their move, by the way. So, or a few months before. So
yeah,
it all kind of like plays in together.
Television wasn't going to let that happen. I mean, television is the driver here. And like, one of my, you know, look, Greg Sankey's not my favorite person, but his favorite book is the blueprint you need to know on where we're headed to some degree. And television is the main, I'm talking about the club, by the way, but
the club. It's about the Premier League's formation.
If we are inching towards that in any way, shape or form, television is a driver. And look, this conversation, it's fun, it's sentimental, and maybe it's a little sad, but the bottom line was, there is no decision, Ross, about trading money for championships, because how foolish would it have been if you're the Oregon Ducks to say, you know what, there really is a value here of 1 week we're going to play Wazoo, then we're going to drive over to Corvallis at the end of the season, but then, you know, we're going to have a regionality and an identity in the Pacific Northwest, or we can survive. Then there is no choice, right? You have to have, look at what the have-nots in the power, in the like the low power two, we got to work on nomenclature there, the non-power two power conference, like, look at the wheeler dealer nonsense they're trying to resolve to stay competitive. There is no choice. So again, Oklahoma, Oregon, there is no choice. It's sad, it feels corrupt, but no individual program is going to stand up for you know, the big feelings of college football fandom and turn down hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah. Well, and it feels like we're moving into the, you know, everything about college football specifically continues to move into more of the direction of the NFL, like we talked about earlier with the calendar and stuff like that. And one of the other things is the sort of the need and requirement just in general for money, right? I mean, like, it, just in pro sports as it is, like, I mean, you guys may know even this more than me, but like, pro franchises, I mean, they are a business, and money is very, very important. And it always was important in college, but not to the level that we're seeing now. I feel like college is like catching up when it comes to the importance of making the buck, catching up to the NFL. And partly is because, as we see, you have to pay the players now.
Are you talking about on the individual sort of, if you treat a school like a franchise, do you mean on that
level? Yeah, sure. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think
the decision making is always like financially based. I guess maybe it wasn't, because they didn't go to a playoff for years, and there's more money in a playoff. So it is interesting, because the finances are probably overcoming the cronyism more. Like, pure financial decisions are overcoming the cronyism. We'll see when the Bulls finally get ditched out of the playoff. But you know, that's
money was the water. Corruption was the levy. And once the money grew big enough, the levy of corruption just couldn't hold it back. So we have a new form of corruption, essentially. But I mean, like, water finds its level. And so we're at a dollar figure now that's just simply impossible to ignore. Anyway, it's about academics, guys.
We got to take one more break. When we come back, though, potential week one upsets. I got one involving Ross's alma mater.
Fascinating. So mean. So mean.
I know.
We'll be right back. All right, guys, before we go, you want to stoke the fires a little bit for week one. Get everybody excited, because we've got some very fun games coming up. And some the thing is, like, it's very hard to predict the games that will absolutely shock us. Like, when we went into the 2007 season, there was literally no one except maybe the strength coach at Appalachian State saying that Appalachian State was going to beat Michigan. Nobody thought that.
Not the Big Ten Network, who put it on as their inaugural game.
First game, which actually was a great business decision, because I just remember I was covering a Florida game that got lightninged out that day. Yeah. And I was like, well, how do I get this
channel? What channel? What channel is this on? Yeah.
So these are the ones that are hard. And I'm going to throw one out there that is actually kind of even, but then a couple G5 power four that look really interesting to me that I'll probably be wrong on, and it'll be something we don't have any inkling of. But let's start out with one of my favorite G5 on G5 matchups of the season.
Oh, definitely.
Boise State at USF.
Yes, without a doubt.
Thursday night, week one.
I'm interested in the underdog here. Because of the G5 level, I tend to default to returning production, given, I'm just going to use a hand motion on an audio format here,
USF is the underdog. They're a 6-point underdog at home, by the way.
I mean, UCF is at the top of the American in returning production. I like a lot of what they've done. They got a lot of seniors. They got a lot of experienced players. It kind of felt like they were supposed to break through last year. Maybe the quarterback.
Byron Brown, their QB, got hurt.
Yeah, but honestly, the kid that came in, Bryce Archie, played really well, and we could have had a really compelling race this spring. And then Archie got drafted by the Reds and was like, cool, I'm going to go play baseball for guaranteed money. Totally understand it. I really like USF this year. They could start 0-3 and still be a really good team because they play Florida and Miami and Boise, not in that order. I like Golish. Look, I like anything with a pro wrestling sensibility, and that little bit of business at FAU last year was just...
Oh, mwah! Before we go on, I didn't mention this about Godfrey's CV. Yes. He's the only one of us that's ever worked for a pro wrestling promotion. Yes. And there will be random Godfrey pro wrestling story times throughout the course of the show.
If Andy asked me to, yes. Yes, if Andy asked me to.
I will ask.
Yes. Golish with an old school, I would say like NWA era heel kind of stare down of Tom Herman. As Tom Herman's wife does, we're all married here. We all understand this. The light but deadly firm grip of the elbow as she escorted him off the field. One of my favorite moments in college football. Okay. All right. I digress. I'm really interested in USF this year. I'm still buyer beware on the breakout potential because they're built like a lot of American teams that I like to watch but have little faith in, which is like, ooh, the offense. Look, I can guarantee you 42, but you're probably going to lose by one and you're going to give up 43. There's a lot of American teams that are built like that this year.
Well, and Boise State, no Ashton Gentry, but yeah. I think Spencer Danielson's defense is going to be pretty good. So that's where this could be quite a bit of fun week one. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Shout out to Boise, Ross, by the way. They do this they did Georgia Southern last year. They go out and find really good G5 teams if they can't plug in a power team, and it does help their resume.
Yeah. And it's potentially like USF has... I'll give you two G5 or two American schools where their non-conference schedule could really help them get into the playoff. USF's one. They probably need to win one of Boise State, Florida, Miami. Two, obviously, would be great.
Yeah.
But Tulane also. Tulane has Northwestern, Duke, and Ole Miss. And they could be
favorites against
2-1 in those games.
Yeah, favorites against Northwestern, I would assume.
All right, let us move from Tampa to the sprawling metropolis that is Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Ross Dellinger, you're a Mississippi State grad. So I'm just breaking down the X's and O's of this game, a fool's errand, because obviously Mississippi State, still a very different roster, not as different as last year, but still different. Southern Miss, a dramatically different roster where Charles Huff comes from winning the Sun Belt at Marshall, ports about a quarter of the Marshall roster to Southern Miss. But the Bulldogs are headed to Hattiesburg, which is that's an interesting trip. They are 10.5-point favorites. Ross, what are the vibes in both places as someone who knows this area very well if Southern Miss wins this game?
Oof. Yeah, it wouldn't be good. Wouldn't be good for the folks at Mississippi State. The hub city as Hattiesburg is known down there. I don't think, you know, this is a series that Mississippi State and Ole Miss, for that matter, because they played Southern Miss a few times too, they really don't want to play, right? I mean, they'd rather not play mm-hmm. them. It's like all those...
No, they pulled out. Yeah, I'll give State credit, Ross. They actually renewed the series. I don't think Ole Miss has played USM, and they lost like two in a row in the early 80s.
Yeah, it's been a while. Yeah. It's been very, that long. Yeah. Wow, I didn't think it had been that long.
I think
long.
It's, but yeah, it's definitely, it was crazy. Before my time.
Yeah, and so because the response always is you're supposed to win, right? So the only thing you can do bad is lose. Yeah. And so why play it at all? And yeah, this is not like, you know, you think about way back, okay, going back to our first conversation about this era, right? This ref share era, like back in the day before the ref share and all that stuff, you know, you're looking at a first year Southern Miss coach that had to overhaul the roster and all that stuff. And this might not be such a difficult game for Mississippi State. But again, as we talked about to open the show, there's schools out there that because of the transfer movement can rebuild in a way. And I mean, Huff has a third of his team that he had at Marshall. This is probably a little scary. And look, let's be honest. I mean, Mississippi State is in a place that's very difficult right now. With the roster and whether it's being poached by, you know, other SEC schools or the changeover in coaches since Mike Leach and all that happened, it's been up and down and up and down. And I don't know what would happen, Andy, if Mississippi State lost this game, but there would be some not too happy people in Starkville. And I think it would cast sort of a fairly darkened cloud over the rest of the year, sort of set the tone for the rest of the season. Be very, very, very hard to come back from that, I would guess, to open the season.
Yeah. Now, a team went into Starkville from the Group of Five and beat Mississippi State last year. So let's talk about that team. One more game, because this is one that I want everybody to keep an eye on. Toledo went into Starkville, beat Mississippi State last year. Jason Candle's obviously done a really great job at Toledo. It's probably the best job in the MAC, and he's won consistently there. He's entering year 10. They go to Kentucky week one. Kentucky's an 8.5-point favorite in this game, but that is, of all the MAC teams to have to play in the opener, Godfrey, that's the one I don't want to see.
No, and you would have heard more about this. Is like, I feel like we're trying to do kind of like tastemaker thing, like keep an eye out on this, or if you're trying to expand your college football palate, you would have heard more about Toledo last year after the upset win, I guess. I mean, they beat the brakes off of State in Starkville, but then they really actually struggled to run the ball down the stretch in MAC play. And the funny thing about Candle, Andy, is he's a great coach. He has lived in that zone of like really great, good for the MAC. He has only two conference titles, but he never really breaks through, gets that job, and gets out of there. So he's been in this sort of liminal state. Tucker Gleason's back at quarterback. They have apparently reworked the offensive line. It's funny because, again, Andy, there was a theme today, and this is the theme. There's a Kentucky running back that will probably start, Chip Trainum, who played at Ohio State 2 years ago, for Toledo in this game. So if they can run the ball effectively, the only like note I have on Kentucky, it's anecdotal. Every time I talk to somebody about the current state of Kentucky football, all it ever ends up being is going back to that contract conversation about Stoops. What are we looking at as far as like the Kentucky football product of 2025? Because there has been a noticeable decline from years past. I think that little bit of a honeymoon that they had, the windows closed for various reasons. And I don't know, like, I think you need to settle back into a 7-win expectation in this dynamic, which, look, if you're a Kentucky fan and you want to be good at football, that sucks because you're paying for way more than that. But as long as that guy's there, I don't see a massive change or evolution coming from Stoops. He's a Stoops.
You're paying SEC championship money, and they're probably not going to be able to do that. And
no.
We saw this happen at South Carolina in the Spurrier era, where they're winning 11 games 3 years in a row. They're beating Clemson 5 years in a row. And it's suddenly South Carolina fans who had suffered for 100 years started to think that was a birthright.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I think that's where Kentucky fans have been, because they got used to being pretty good. And That's really hard to do at Kentucky. And but the problem is, it's human nature when you start to succeed, and also our lizard brains, when you start spending that money, it's like, well, hey, we're kind of paying what Alabama's paying. Like, how come we don't get Alabama results?
Would be curious if the same thing happens to Toledo this year, where except they actually can hold it together and run the ball well and win the MAC. Andy, guys, they could be that G5 spot contender, but then their SEC win would not look that great. And they kind of need it to, because they play at Wazoo, but I don't think that's going to get them much in terms of committee consideration.
Guys, I cannot wait to see what happens in that game. But to call back to something Godfrey just said, and also to the general theme of the show of the new world, the movement, how all of this works. You just mentioned that Chip Traynham, the starting tailback for the Toledo Rockets. Chip Traynham started his career at Arizona State, played pretty well, bumped up to Ohio State, didn't play as well as he wanted to, down to Kentucky. Now, he's a Toledo Rocket. He's playing against Kentucky. Holy Toledo. That's college football in 2025. This has been a pleasure. We will talk to you again on Thursday.